WNST, Towson Baltimore, and WNST. We are Baltimore Positive. Don Moeller joining us here. We've been through so many segments here and talking about the big congressional race. The election's sort of a weird day. A lot of folks don't know about it. You'll be hearing more about it in the coming days because there's only days left until February 4th. This guy is a veteran of all things Congressional District 7. And a full disclosure, a neighbor of mine, and I've been knowing him since I was a guest on The Bottom Line back at WBAL 20 years ago. We welcome Kwaisi Mfume back on, former president of and CEO of the NAACP, and of course, a five-term. You like this job so much you want it again, huh?
I did, and I do. Absolutely. And hello to you. Great to be on the show.
Great to have you. I kidded Nestor. I said I ran into you at a recent event in Catonsville, and you said, yeah, it just seemed like time to put the band back together.
yeah, the Blues Brothers style.
Well, yeah, run us through this. I mean, obviously, relationships with Elijah run deep for almost all of the candidates, living here, serving here, all the things you've been through. But I have a feeling you weren't expecting to do this 5-6 months ago. No one was. This forced a lot of people into thinking, hey, this would be a good time for me to go to D.C. and serve.
Yeah, you're right. In fact, in August, Elijah and I were on the phone laughing and joking about him getting better, and he was teasing me, saying he can't wait for October. He said, I'm going to throw this damn walker away and walk right into my office. And I said to him, don't throw it too far, as I might be a senior citizen like you. I might have to pick it up and borrow it. So we were just shooting the breeze. You know, having a good time talking about things. He was dealing with his illness, but his attitude was great. So you fast forward from there to October 17th when he transitioned and left this earth. It was just too fast, too soon, and, I didn't expect it, and I know Elijah didn't. But I helped to eulogize him at the funeral, as you know, and Elijah and I have known each other for 43, 44 years, so we've been friends a long, long time. And I couldn't help but to think after the burial and everything had subsided and sort of people were turning the page, I was asking the question, what is next? I mean, what do we do for our district and what can we do? So it was the can part that I focused on because I thought, and I still do, that if we could send someone to Washington to represent us that was proven, tested, ready to go on day one, that had seniority that had accrued, most of which would come back, in this case, to me.
You know, I wasn't aware of that, Congressman, that when you go back, you get your seniority back.
You get it, but it's totally the decision of the Democratic caucus. Do you get 100%? Do you get 95%? Do you get 90%? It's a subjective decision, but you do get some of it back.
I'll be darned.
And, the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and my friend Jim Clyburn all pretty much head up the caucus, I feel good about the fact of getting back as much of my tenure as possible if I'm fortunate enough to be elected. So when I thought about all those things, I was checking all of my own boxes and didn't even know it and realized that more than anything, this is an opportunity to not lose a chance to keep the pace going. I think you replace strong leadership with strong leadership. And I was fortunate enough to be elected, as you said, for five terms with 82% of the vote each time. So I think I'd like to believe I was doing something right for the people of our district, for them to keep returning me at such a high rate. And it was a chance for me to serve under the administrations of three United States presidents. I served as Speaker Pro Tem of the House. I chaired the only joint committee of the House and Senate, which is a joint economic committee. I had a chance to chair the Congressional Black Caucus. And those 10 years of seniority gave me an opportunity to pass a lot of very good and meaningful legislation, like the Violence Against Women's Act and the last civil rights bill that passed the Congress, and Americans with Disabilities Act, and the fact that I was part of the group that co-authored and passed the ban on assault weapons that expired, and the Congress did not and has not bothered to reaffirm or reauthorize that. I guess what I'm saying is that I got up every day here in Baltimore, drove to Washington, and worked as hard as I could and as long as I could to do the sort of things that I thought were important for our district. No matter where people lived in the district, no matter what their race, no matter what their religion, it was all about trying to find a way to create an opportunity for this district to be well represented. So I'm ready to do that again. And when I thought about what would be next, I realized that I am the only person that has congressional experience. I know most of the people there. I know what it takes to get things done because I've gotten things done. And in this instance, I wanted to present myself along with all the other candidates for the consideration of voters.
Kwasi, I've known you a while, and if I ran into you in the lobby, as sometimes we do, or in an elevator or wherever, I would say to you, and I'll say this just—it's not flippant—but why didn't you run for mayor? Like, why this opportunity, and what moves you toward a job you once had, knowing that there's a real issue here in the city. You know that. I know that we own land here, right? Mm-hmm. That we couldn't give away if we tried to some degree. I guess people ask you that all the time, but I heard your name in those circles as much as before Elijah passed, that you do want to serve people. It's who you are, man. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I know you are called where there's a need, right?
That's right. And I hope I'm called in most instances where there's a need, and then I realize it. But with respect to the office of mayor, I found myself pretty much supporting other people who were running who I thought would make a difference. And I have to tell you that this city has gone in a direction, meaning Baltimore now, that none of us ever expected would happen. And it's gone that way kind of rapidly, and there's an opportunity now on April 28th to correct course. And I've looked at some of the candidates, and without trying to suggest or guess who's going to win the race, I can tell you this. Everybody that I talk to wants to try something different. They believe that we've got to do something different in terms of the mayor's office, and that might be, in fact, reflected in the polls. But I was always driven to the United States Congress, which is why in 2006 I ran for the Senate, not just to be the first African-American senator from Maryland, but to be somebody who kind of came up through a story of redemption, grew up in the streets, got saved, and turned around, learned about life the hard way, and learned how to appreciate the basic values that I was given as a child. We were taught to work hard, play by the rules, love your country, cherish your faith, respect your elderly, and most of all, respect yourself. And when that did not work out, I came about 3% short, I think, 3.5%. I was pretty much doing other things. So I've been out at Morgan State University. I chair the Board of Regents there. I spent 12 years at Johns Hopkins on the Board of Trustees during that. I headed up the National Medical Association, which is the oldest civil organization representing black physicians. And in addition to that, I have been serving on the board as vice chair of Research America, the largest research advocacy group in the country, fighting on behalf of NIH and the Centers for Disease Control and the National Science Foundation. And then if I really had some time left, I did what I could with Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Central Maryland and the Boy Scouts of America. So I've been busy.
You haven't just been kicking back.
Party, I was an Obama surrogate in 2008. I worked all the battleground states for him and did it again later in 2012. So this, for me, is an opportunity, as I said before, to offer myself up for service. It will be, as it should be, totally up to the voters. I encourage everybody to look at the field of candidates, listen to us, read about us, and try to make a decision based on where you want this district to be represented in the future.
Well, it's fascinating for you. All these years, you still say, I offer myself up. I mean, that's literally, you're saying, I'm going to give this period of my time to doing the best I can do. That's all any candidate can offer, right?
Yeah, I think we are who we are. And when we pretend to be something else, we are doing it for the wrong reasons. Public service is very, very respectful of the fact that good people will find their way there, and bad people will find their way out of that. When I was approached to leave the NAACP and, leave the Congress, give up my safe seat and go try to save the NAACP, I was really torn with this whole issue of public service. I was doing fine in the United States Congress. Everybody in the district kept electing me overwhelmingly. But when Merle Evers, the widow of Medgar Evers, who had been assassinated years ago in Jackson, Mississippi, came to me and said, I just can't keep the organization together any longer. We're losing membership. We're $4 million in debt. Our branches are closing up. We are the nation's oldest and largest civil rights organization. Would you consider leaving your safe seat and coming to try to save us? I really had to ask myself, are you really about public service, or are you just like being called Mr. Chairman all day long and having people run behind you in Congress and get your water and open your doors? Or are you prepared to do something that most people will think you're crazy to do and try to save the organization? And as you know, I decided that I would, in fact, leave the Congress to do that. I called Elijah the night before I made the announcement and said, Elijah, look, tomorrow I'm going to announce that I am going to leave the Congress, go and try to save this historic organization. People are going to think that I'm crazy. I don't want you to think that way, but I do want you to consider one thing. I think, Elijah, you should run for this seat. I think you'll be a great representative, and if you step out on faith like I'm doing, I think you'll be rewarded. Elijah did that, got elected, and gave us 23 wonderful years of service.
I said, a giant. Truly, I've talked to the other candidates, Congressman, and I say, we're not talking about replacing just a run-of-the-mill congressman. We're talking about someone whose footsteps are gigantic and left a mark on this nation that will be there for decades.
Great guy. I mean, a great guy, aside from being a great personal friend. Just a good person.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the NAACP, and there was a little dust-up, and it's not a news story. I want you to have a chance to talk about it. There was a news story that, you know, they gave you credit, which is what you're talking about, for getting the NAACP out of its financial difficulties that it was in and really turning the organization around. But then they said at the end there was sort of a dust-up between Mr. Mfumi and some of the board
and
members.
And Julian Bond, basically.
Yeah, Julia. How do you – I mean, you've been above the fray on that. But then even Julian said, right, but he did turn the organization around. What do you say to that story? It's not a news story.
No, it's not. It's like every time I decide to offer myself for public service particularly the Sun paper wants to do a new version of an old story. But, you know, that's what they do. I understand that. I'm a big guy. I think the real story here is that whenever you have two very strong-willed persons, there are going to be differences of opinion. And Julian and I were no different. We did not agree on everything. We agreed on a lot of things, but the things we didn't disagree on, he held his position, I held mine. That kind of give and take takes place in every organization, I think, particularly 501c3 public organizations that are nonprofit with a strong board. And when you have a strong CEO, it's the give and take and the tug that takes place. If it makes a story for some people, then so be it. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is, did you move the needle? And in this case, the answer is yes. The organization was saved. I left there on a firm footing. When I came there, it was a $4 million surplus. When I left, or $4 million deficit. When I left, there was a surplus. And halfway through the 9 years, the board awarded me with a brand new contract and a salary increase. And signed and awarded by Julian Bond and the board. So I don't know that I can say much more, right, except that he saw things one way sometimes and I saw them the other.
I wanted to give you a chance just to clarify. We're speaking with former Congressman Kwesi Mfumi, former head of the NAACP, one of the cast of thousands running to represent those of us who live
in the 7th
district.
You're not shocked. There's many people. I mean, I don't know what point you woke up in the middle of the night and said, I'm going to do this, you know, after Elijah passed, but to this many people, this is quite the race, right, for in sort of a weird election all the way around that a lot of folks, I'm sure you walk up and say, I'm doing this. They might not know you're doing it. And they certainly might not know when you're doing it, right?
Yeah, you know, my wife and I sat down at the kitchen table to talk about this and decided I needed to also bring into the conversation my sisters and my adult sons, because I wanted my entire family to weigh in about whether or not, in this case, the husband or the father or their brother should, in fact, try one more time to offer himself up to the public for service because I wanted to, and they knew it was in my heart, but they also, I knew that they would tell me the right answer because they're more concerned about me than other things. And they all said together, look, we're with you 100%. We want to do this together as a family. You've got our support. Now go out there and win it. So that's how it started. Now, I didn't know that it was going to be 24 candidates in the race. This has only been going on since November the 4th. One of the interesting things, though, is that I was not shocked because when I willingly gave up the seat to go try to save the NAACP and got Elijah into the race, in that special election, like this one, there were 23 candidates. And Elijah and I used to say, can you believe this? And we'd say, yes, we can, because it's true. So here we go again. We've picked up one additional candidate. So
we're gaining.
Inflation.
February 4th, we say, folks, Nestor and I keep shaking our heads, Congress. We say February 4th, then again April 28th, then again November the 3rd. I mean, this is indeed a unique situation. But let's get specific, because I want to give you, we want to give you the same opportunity we've given everyone else. So let's talk, let's get past the politics stuff of it and talk policy. I mean, you're a policy guy. Healthcare, you're going to go there. You're going to be one of 435 if you end up winning this sprint to this election. Where are you on the whole healthcare debate we're having in the nation?
Well, I believe that what has happened to Obamacare is short of just being a sin. The president, through executive order, has whittled away some of that bill, and with a wink and a nod to the enforcement agencies, many of them are not enforcing the bill on the ground and making sure that they're working with states to provide the kind of care and the amount of care that's required, necessary, and possible. So I've said all along, the first thing for me is to help restore Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, back to the way it was. And then after that restoration, to expand it so that we lower the age of eligibility, that we bring more people in who, in fact, can take advantage of it. And that becomes our starting point. In addition to that, I believe strongly that we've got to find a way to lower the cost of prescription medications. And this is not just for the elderly. This is for everybody who has to take any kind of medication because we're paying too much money. We're one of the few countries that will not allow the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare to buy and negotiate drug prices on the open market, like other countries. And so we're buying at the seller's price, which is in most cases higher than it ordinarily would be, and it's passed along to people who have to go in to the CVS or the Walgreens and pay for a prescription. We can do a whole lot better than that, and I think we have to. This issue of Medicare for all is a great issue, but I think that if on the Democratic side, we've got to be proactive enough to point out how, in fact, it's paid for. Otherwise, we're going to be trying to sell something that people are not trying to buy. And I think it can be paid for. I think this is one of the things that hurt Elizabeth Warren recently. She's taken a lot of heat, and so has Bernie, about this because they haven't really always identified dollar for dollar how we're going to do this. But short of that, I support the concept. And more readily, I support expanding Medicaid as well, so that we have more people who are covered under that and protected under that the way it was meant when it was first designed. So those are some of my thoughts, not all of them, on health care. It's an issue that is just kind of out there now, and because we have an election, people are dancing around it, but I believe strongly we've got to restore Obamacare, expand it, protect and preserve Medicaid and Medicare, lower prescription drugs, and do some of the more proactive things from a health perspective to help people on the ground.
Kwesi, you served a long time in 10 years and back in the day and three presidents and all of that stuff. The impeachment that was laid out before everyone, you would have been a part of that in some way in the modern era. As an American, I was appalled watching all of it. I'm appalled watching what these senators have done, and McConnell, and it's one of the reasons I'm on here talking politics with you and policy and the future of Baltimore, because 30 years of doing sports radio, you know, we've known each other a long time. We got a lot of issues here in Baltimore, but nothing bigger than I think the country at this point. And just to see the discourse from one side of the aisle to the other, do you even recognize it 25 years later?
I really don't. You know, I was part of a group where you had people like Tip O'Neill and Jim Wright, and on the Republican side, Bob Michael of Illinois. All of these people were fiercely partisan, but they were also very much aware that in order to get things done, you have to be bipartisan. And so the Speaker of the House would let everybody and both sides fight it out all day long on the floor. And, you know, the gentleman from Ohio is wrong, and the gentlelady from New York is wrong, and we'd go back and forth. But at the end of the day, they'd round up a bunch of the leadership on both sides and go around to the Democratic Club or the Republican Club on the Hill and sit down and have a beer or something to eat and talk about, okay, we know how we feel. Now, how do we take one step backwards to take one step, to take two steps forward to get both of us to where we need to be? And they always seem to find a way to find a compromise so that both sides could go back to their constituents in Port Isle and how they won on the things that were most important to them. That's not happening anymore. This is a scorched earth policy that the Congress has. It's my way or no way. And you're not just somebody that disagrees with me. Quote, you are the enemy. And that's how different people on both sides see one another. You're not going to get anything done that way. Most people, in my opinion, are not on the far right or on the far left. Most people in this country are in the middle. They want a good, safe community. They want to know that life's going to be better for their children than it was for them. They want to believe that the American dream is still very much alive and well. They want to believe that there's fairness and equity. And they want to believe that we can argue but still find a way to reach consensus. That consensus is just missing on so many issues today that it has turned people off, which is why most people don't identify with a party anymore. Most people who are registering as independents. And it means also that it's tearing at the heartstrings and the fabric of the democracy that we all swore to uphold and preserve.
I could not agree more. I think it's dangerous times. It's funny that you said that, not on the left, not on the right, in the center. It's hard to put a number on it, but I've always hung it at about 20, 20, 60. I've said to folks, just always remember, our strength is going to be in that 60 there in the middle. It may be 15 or 20 on one fringe, 15 or 20 on the other. But most of them, you know, what I hear, Congressman, and react to this, what I hear all the time at the dinner table, at family gatherings, out socially with friends, is people are just frustrated that Tip O'Neill ethic that you talked about, the Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan thing, we're all friends after six. Let's sit down, have a beer, and figure out how we can move forward.
We're all Americans.
They don't see that existing anymore. They see this, I think you used the term scorched earth. How can you, I think it's what people want to hear, how can you, going down there as one of 435, try to make a difference?
Well, I think I try the way I try every day. I get up and put one foot in front of the other and take one step at a time. You know what I found as a Democrat in the Congress all those years and what many on the other side found is that we really are more about our similarities and our differences,
right.
And we've got to find a way to let our differences be there but not dictate how we act and how we think and what we do when it comes to this nation and the people in this nation. It's really a matter of finding people on the other side who are approachable, building relationships, and getting people to understand that the only way that anything is going to get done is to step back from this brink of destruction that we seem to always be at, where we're at each other's throats. And so you got this group and you got that group, and nobody is being talked to. So what I did early on when I got there, I mean, Paul Sarbanes and Barbara Mikulski were the two best teachers I ever had. They said, look, Kwaisi, here's how we make it work. We stick to our principles, and at the same time, we recognize that people on the other side have principles, and we try to find the common ground, the common touches, and that's where we build on. And if we build 3 feet in the air from being on the ground, at least we're 3 feet higher than we were today, and we try that each and every day. And we fight for what we believe in, but at the same time, we believe that the fight has to also include reaching out. I did that, and I was very successful on both sides of the aisle, and you know, it was something that I'll never forget because it allowed you to maintain your principles, your dignity, and who you were. But it also said you were prepared to find a way to create progress so they wouldn't be deadlock and gridlock. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way the government shuts down now, it's like annually. You almost expect it in December. Then park workers aren't going to get paid, and FBI workers aren't going to get paid, and federal workers aren't going to get paid, and 3 days turn into 3 weeks. It's almost a way of life, and I think we have to reverse that by showing there's another way to do this.
Well, before we let you go, and I appreciate you taking time here to sit down and talk with us, the next couple of issues that I need you to talk about, and I know you've thought about them deeply, they all seem to go together for me. And I'm talking about crime, where we're losing a generation of young black men in cities across America. Opioids, where we're just having people die day in and day out across America. Jobs and affordable housing. I mean, it seems to me those four things, you can't break away from: jobs, housing, opioids, and crime. How does the federal government, what should the federal government be doing on those issues, Congressman?
Well, the first thing on jobs is that the federal government ought to be the stimulator, the engine that creates the sort of impetus to move toward business creation, which then moves toward jobs. And some of that, in my opinion, particularly as it relates to urban areas like Baltimore, means finding a way to create economic engines in communities, which are called micro business enterprises. There's so many people who have the desire or are currently struggling in business that the government used to really, through the SBA, provide a way for them to borrow money, pay it back at a great rate, and be able to expand and grow businesses. They, in turn, hired people from the community, and you had all these little engines working where one group is employing 10 and another business is employing 5 and another one is employing 20. We don't see that anymore. I mean,
it's Walmart or bust, right? Kind of, sort of, right?
Yeah, we don't see that happening, and we don't see that kind of encouragement coming. So I think the government has to be the engine that jumpstarts this whole thing about micro business enterprise. Nobody creates a multi-million-dollar corporation out of the blue. Most businesses start as small businesses. They struggle, and whether they're in the city or the county, they've got to know that they've got a government that's going to protect their interests as best they can and provide stimulus, because the greatest impediment is the access to capital and the access to credit. You give that to any business, and they will find a way to grow it. On the housing side, we need a greater housing supply. We ought to start with that because it's not kept pace with the population in this country, which has been growing exponentially. We've had pretty much the same housing stock. And so what we find ourselves with, and you know, and this is a really real case for Baltimore, we find ourselves with situations where people have nowhere to live, or people are living in such a population-dense building or a housing unit that it's not good for anybody. And when you look at the number of vacants in Baltimore City, as I did this morning and as I do every day, makes me long for the days when William Donald Schaefer created the $1 homestead program, where you said to somebody, we'll sell you this building for a dollar. It's gutted. It looks bad. It's terrible. But you've got to make a promise to live in the city and live in it for at least 5 years. And the money that you would ordinarily take for a mortgage, we want you to use that money to refurbish the building. I mean, the housing stock here has to be replenished, or it's got to be torn down. But in any either case, we just can't continue to have vacants sit around becoming fire hazards and impediments to community growth at all. In the area of education, I think it's clear, for me at least, that we've got to advocate for new school construction, as our dear friend Kevin Kamenetz did in Baltimore County, that we've got to find a way to make sure that we are doing the right kind of recruitment and of teachers. All regular teachers will tell you we're getting old, and we need to know that there's a good supply of teachers behind us. But there's got to be recruitment and proper training to bring them in, because at the end of the day, they're dealing with the most important asset, our children, whether we're living in Howard County, Baltimore City, or Baltimore County. I believe that. I believe it strongly. I believe that Title I has to be protected and expanded. And I just think that the issues of education are so important that we see now this drive toward Kerwin and the adoption of the Kerwin recommendations here in the state, which I assume are going to pass. There should also be equity.
I love that you assume that, by the way. We've been fighting that
We've been shouting from the housetop.
We saw Bill on television the other night beating on the table.
take us to the violence.
I think this is the year that it happens. I really do.
Fingers crossed.
I'm an eternal optimist, but sometimes I'm also paranoid because I don't believe that Humpty Dumpty just fell.
Right.
But he was pushed. So it depends on the issue. But on Kerwin, I'm optimistic that this is the year that it's going to pass. And if it does, that's great for all of us, and it's great for education. But we've also got to think about the environment as we talk about education. I mean, the EPA has to enforce existing laws and cannot, again, through a wink and a nod, tell violators that they could do what they want to do. We've got to commit as a nation to reduce carbon emissions to zero, and we do that working with the greatest enemy of that, which is the auto industry in Michigan, by telling them, look, this is the way it's going to be. We're not going to force it on you in 2 days or 2 weeks, but we've got to find a way to get emissions down to net zero. We've got to move toward a green economy, and we've got to do the things in urban areas, particularly that we're protecting water from seepage, where there are all sorts of toxic dump sites that have buried over and built on, where the water now is seeping out into the land, and we are getting close to a situation like we had in Flint, Michigan. So there's a lot to be dealt with. I've got the energy. I think I have the foresight. Well, I know I listen to everybody, because I've always believed that the best ideas come from the bottom up, from the people who are most affected and most concerned. That's the kind of representative I want to be again in Congress.
I can't let you get away, Congressman. I just need to get your take on it, because I find it heartbreaking each and every day. You know, we talk to folks who've lost loved ones. We've got this guns and violence issue. It's an issue all over the United States, but certainly an issue with young black men in our cities. What do we do about guns and violence?
Well, you know, I've said this all along. I think you just got to get tough on guns. It's very simple. It's not telling people they can't own a gun, but it's making sure that we do some things on the front end that we know work. We know that background checks have helped, but background checks are not as strong as they should be. There's no mental health component of that. And so many people who legally can go and purchase a gun, like some of these young kids and others that have them legally, have a mental problem. And that mental problem causes them to act out. And when they act out in schools, they act out against us and everything else. So I honestly believe that we've got to change and force as a nation the Congress to deal with that issue so that we're preventing. The other thing is that I helped to write the only assault weapons ban in this country. It was in effect from 1995 to 2005, and the only reason it wasn't permanent was because we couldn't get enough votes to pass it that way. So we worked out a compromise, which was better than not having anything at all, believing that the next enlightened Congress, long after us, surely would reauthorize the assault weapons ban. They did not do that, and they haven't done it now for 15 years. So that's a priority of mine, because I understand what's happened out here with assault weapons and how the kind of carnage that comes about through these weapons is hurting and scaring all of us as Americans. We've got to get back to community policing. The last thing that I did before I left the Congress was work on a bill to get $16 billion into the hands of mayors across this country for community policing. Great initiatives, working with young people in centers, working with the police department in these cities, and working with those individuals and community organizations that wanted community policing. Those are three things, but let me tell you something that's not on the list. The other thing is that kids today have to be taught values. They have to be taught values. And when I say that, I heard the police commissioner say, you know, the decision to stab someone or to shoot someone is a decision that's quick and oftentimes made because there is nothing that attaches to it. And the only thing that attaches to it, in my opinion, are basic values. When you're taught to value life, when you have some faith, when you have some belief that there are things that you just don't do. You play by the rules. You work hard. You love your country. You cherish your faith. You respect elderly and you respect yourselves. And, you know, people get on me when I say that, but I will say that until I have no breath again, because we have to find a way to intervene with kids now who are 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, because in 10 or 12 years, they'll either be on the right track in most instances, or they will be completely off the track if they're not getting basic values, love, and instructions.
Kwesi, man, it's been
great
nothing but
visit.
Love for a quarter of a century with you. We appreciate you and respect your you taking the hat off, throwing it in the ring here. The election will be on February the 4th, representing Maryland's 7th Congressional District for the vacated seat of dearly departed Elijah Cummings. Kwesi Mfume has been our guest. We've been talking to lots of the congressional candidates. You can find them all out at Baltimore Positive.
Vote.
Kwesi, take care. I know you want everybody to vote, everybody to register to vote, right? This is the most important important year in the history of our country. I'm 51 years into this. You know, I dropped the Oriole and Raven baton to start talking about this because that's how important I feel it is, you know?
Well, thank you, Nestor. And one thing I do want people to know instinctively, that we are not a perfect nation, and we are not perfect people. And yet, God called all of us to a perfect mission, and that is to take this fragile democracy that we are bound to protect, and to protect it, and to grow it, and to not give it up. I believe that racism and sexism and anti-Semitism are wrong. They tear away at that fabric. I believe that black bigotry is just as cruel and evil as white bigotry or any other kind, that we can't allow bigots to be in too many places. And I believe that gay bashing and immigrant bashing and union bashing all work together to undermine the principles of this democracy that people have fought and died for of all races. And so while we are not a perfect nation, we do have before us as Americans a perfect mission.
Perfect place to stop. Congressman, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. Nestor, democracy is not
a spectator sport. Get
there
involved. Gleisi Mfume running for 7th. The election is February 4th. Get out, vote. West Side, North Side, Howard County,
wherever
Baltimore
it is.
County, wherever you are. He's Don. I'm Nestor. We are Baltimore Positive, and we never stop talking Baltimore issues and making Baltimore better.